Phil Tiger. Slacker Podcast.
Hello, Slackers. I hope you're all good. I hope you're well. I hope your lockdown is going pretty good. I mean, as good as it possibly can be. It's not like we're being sent to war or we're like being taken away from our houses and being forced to move country. Like, we're all that's being asked of us is to be in the house, staying away from other people. I'm sure we can do that until this calms down a little bit. And as this sort of progresses, the more and more podcasts I'm going to record. I haven't actually done that many through Zoom or Zencaster or any of the numerous different ways of recording podcasts online. And I've started doing some now. I've recorded a few, and they're sounding pretty good. So this series is going to be a good bit longer than I had anticipated. The podcasts that we're listening to at the minute, the ones you've listened to so far in this season, and the podcast today as well, is they were all done over the last couple of months, so they were all done face to face. So I think you'll notice like the sort of dip in audio quality when we get there, but it still sounds good. It's still fine. I've been passing the time this week working on some radio sketches with some friends. I was doing my Chilla show on Radio 1 on Sunday. I was covering for Annie Mac last night on Radio 1. I had an interview with Mike Skinner live on the radio, and he swore twice on it, and it was hilarious. We had to cut Mike Skinner off halfway through, going, "All right, Mike, no more swearing. Thanks very much." Right, okay, I'm not going to blather on for too long. All I can say is that the podcast is sponsored by the Slacker's Guide to the Music Industry. It is the one-stop shop for anybody who wants to release music or get their music out there, or just learn a little bit more about the music industry. You can pick that up on my website, which is philtaggartslacker.com. Mad love to the new Patreons from last week who've come on to support the podcast, which is incredible. Like, it's like, you are really, really helping keep the podcast going. I'm trying to like not do advertisements in this season, which, I mean, from a financial point, it's probably really stupid, but from a personal point, it means I don't have to flog a load of old shite, which is just the best way to be. Do you know what I mean? It just makes it, I don't know, it makes it feel a little bit purer. So I'm trying the Patreon out to see whether that actually works. So if you want to donate to the podcast or support it in any way, and you enjoy it and you want it to keep on going, then go to patreon.com/slackerpodcast. This week, it is all about Alt-J. I went to one of their houses in Dalston. I'm not going to give you the full address, unless you are top tier. Maybe that's a good top tier for the Patreon. If you're top tier of the Patreon, I'll give out all the addresses of the people I interview. I went to his house, which is lovely, lovely, lovely gaff, and sat down and we talked quite a lot and at length about the career of Alt-J and various different bits and pieces. I think there were some weird business ideas that were coming up. There's a lot of talk about oysters. And we have a special demo, as we do every single week as well. Here it is, the Slacker Podcast with Alt-J in 3, 2, 1. This is a different podcast for myself. Like, I'm in your house.
I'm wearing slippers.
You are wearing slippers. As soon as I came through the door, I did my normal Irish farmer thing and just slouched on in without taking my shoes off. And I've got very like paranoid since I've been in here and stand on your lovely rug with like shoes. They're not dirty.
Cool. It's fine. Shoes off upstairs is the only rule in this house.
Yeah, I can feel that. Like, yeah. you got nice carpet going on up there.
Yeah, well, you know, when you do a lot of touring, you really feel like treating yourself to a nice carpet. What can I say? Welcome back to the Interiors Podcast.
I'm telling you, man, there's a market out there there's a podcast for anything out there, really. Like,
yeah, that's very true.
Do you listen to any
podcasts?
Yeah,
many. Yes, I do. I mean, I listen to your you know, standard ones. I love Adam Buxton. I listen to a lot of cricket podcasts. Mm-hmm. And then, like, I wanted to try and start. I still want to try and start a podcast about oysters. I'm an oyster lover.
Really?
Mm. And I approached a few people, like fellow musicians. Dan from Bastille made very polite noises about it, but it hasn't happened yet. Leanne Havas never got back to me. So I lost confidence in my idea of the podcast.
Do you think people might have been humouring you?
I don't know. I mean, I think because basically it started because Joe and I, Joe from the band, when we were making our third album, we both used to live, walking down Broadway Market in Hackney was sort of both of our way to get into Shoreditch where we were recording. And there's mm-hmm. a fishmonger there that does oysters. And we used to quite often have what we called a slippery breakfast together, which was having some oysters at like 10 in the morning on the way to the studio. And then we would like chat to the fishmonger, chat to each other, you know, I was just sort of like, this could be a podcast basically, a couple of people eating some oysters and, you know, sort of shooting the breeze. Wouldn't be a very long podcast, maybe.
Until you get somebody who's allergic to shellfish and has anaphylactic shock.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Dies.
I would definitely make sure
I would tune into that.
Dotted the I's and crossed the T's before that. But anyway, but also I was going to call it Shuck Buddies, which I thought was a really great name.
I was trying to think of like what I would call it. And I was like, down the neck.
Down the neck is down, quite good.
Down the neck podcast with Gus.
Yeah, but... it hasn't got off the ground yet. I might have to pick your brains afterwards for any podcasting tips, or maybe right now. I don't know.
Well, you never know. Like there might be some fishing companies or haulage companies or whatever that might like want to jump into bed with you on this
sponsorship. I mean,
that's
sponsored
it.
Sponsored by you're not Bird's Eye, Maersk,
Bird's Eye Oysters.
Yeah,
You're not meant to. Like, I've never actually had them. Like the idea of it kind of. I'm fascinated by them because I was in Gothenburg a couple of weeks ago and my missus was eating them like they were going out of fashion.
I just thought being Irish you'd be all over them.
Yeah, well, like apparently so, but I just like have a thing where I have a mental block where I think I'm allergic to shellfish even though I know I'm not.
Okay, yeah. No, it's fair enough. I mean, my wife doesn't like oysters. I think this is part of the problem is that I chose a food stuff that few people have even tried, let alone like.
But that's a good reason to get into it, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, I suppose everyone needs a niche.
Like one thing that's been aimed at your band over the years is the Randy lyrics that you have, right? Like, I'm starting to join the dots here because, like, obviously oysters are a natural aphrodisiac.
So they say.
And if you're necking them before going into the studio and writing lyrics, you're gonna be writing like a Mills and Boone.
I've never thought of that. I mean, there is a song on our third album, which is called "Hit Me Like That Snare," which is, I mean, frankly, so top shelf that even I often skip it when listening to the album because it makes me embarrassed. I've never made that connection before. Joe and I were eating a hell of a lot of oysters during those sessions. Well, so
there you go. Like, it's like, I don't know, if you keep going the way you're going, the next album might be like 50 Shades of Grey or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. It might actually have to have one of those parental advisory stickers on it, which, let's face it, is every musician's dream.
Exactly. Well, I mean, you have
listening to Eminem.
Oh, dude. You should have them on your stickers already.
I don't know if they do. Do they still do them? I don't know. It feels a bit 90s.
The track it's "Educated by Last Exit to Brooklyn."
Yeah, I mean,
talks about somebody getting.
Yeah, that's not even.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If you're a
fan,
you know. Yeah. We don't have to talk
if you
about
know,
it.
You know.
It's too early in the day. Yeah.
I haven't had my oysters yet.
If you know, you know. Yeah. So we start every podcast the same way with an early demo, and the one I have here from you. It says on YouTube it was published in 2013, but I know that is only when it was published. It was out a long time beforehand.
I think, I'm not even sure who put this up on YouTube. Someone called Anakin.
Anakin
Skywalker.
88 subscribers. All J as, can you pronounce that, please?
So that Daljit Dalywell, which was our first band name.
Yeah. So let's hear it.
I love you, Leon, yeah, I love you.
you have it, an advertisement for healthy fast food chain Leon. Alt-J demo there. What era of Alt-J was that? Was that the very beginning?
Yeah, that was one of the first songs we ever wrote, really. I think we played that at our first, or certainly our second gig, I would say, in 2008 or 9. So it's one of two songs, that and Matilda, which are about the film Leon. Mm-hmm. You ever seen that film?
Yeah.
Seen it.
Long time ago.
Yeah, Joe had this obsession with that film and may still harbour an interest in writing a whole sort of like musical or opera about it.
Wow, okay.
I don't know if you'd appreciate me saying that.
Well, but, you've heard it here first. Now. Yeah, completely exactly. Confirmed Andrew Lloyd
Webber.
I think
it'd be great. I mean, you know, like it's a very, you know, as a film, it's, you know, the sort of the love story and the violence and all of it, it would work extremely well on the stage, I think. And I mean, I love that song, Leon. It never seemed quite, I don't know why we didn't put it on our first album. Well, I suppose I do know in that it just seemed a bit, I think we just saw it as slightly juvenile in terms of its, I don't know how it was written or something. I don't know, but I get a massive bang out of listening to it. I know a lot of our fans really like it. Joe's dad, who's like Jay's biggest fan, I suppose, and you know, really often says, "Oh, I really think you should have, you know, put Leon on an album." You know,
you're like, "Okay, Captain Hindsight."
Yeah, exactly. you know, I think it's a really cool song, and that was recorded in the bedroom in Leeds, in Will's bedroom on Ash Grove in Hyde Park.
When you got together to write something like that, it feels like it's not educated by one particular band, and you can't normally attribute that to any band starting out. Normally their first song you'll be like, oh, that sounds a little bit like X, that sounds a little bit like Y. Every band's first song sounds a little bit like something, because you're trying to find your feet musically to sound like your own self. Like, but I can't sort of like pick who that's like.
I know. I mean, I guess there's maybe something a bit kind of like 80s indie about it. But then I don't think any of us were actually into that kind of thing. You know, and I'm not a huge music like geek anyway, so I couldn't really accurately say, oh, it sounds like early, you know, Joy Division or something. I don't know. I mean, if I had to say it sounds like something like that, I'd probably put it in that era. But yeah, I think we've always been one of those bands that, you know, did just not quite exist. It was hard to tell who our influences were, and I'm not sure we really had any influences, to be honest.
Is that because you were all coming to it from different places?
Yeah, I think so. I think it was that we all had different backgrounds, different tastes in music. I mean, by backgrounds, I mean like musical backgrounds. You know, I was like a classical musician, also quite influenced by my mum's family, who were really into like folk music. Joe was sort of a self-taught guitarist, really influenced by his dad, who played like classics in the pub, and you know, grew up listening to lots of stuff like Laurel Canyon kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Tom had been in metal bands. He was really exclusively into metal basically when we started the band, and Gwil had kind of grown up listening mainly to hip-hop, I think. And so it was this weird stew of influences and styles and disciplines that became Alt-J or Dalja Dhaliwal or whatever. And I think we really let the chemistry guide it, rather than sitting down and being like, right, who do we want to sound like? Who do we like? You know, that kind of thing.
There wasn't a conversation like that. Like,
no,
it was like, here we are. Like, was there somebody who led the way, who was like the person who really made the project take off?
Yeah, definitely Joe, 100% Joe. Yeah. I mean, Joe took it unbelievably seriously from day one, really, which was great, because if I have a fault, well, I have many faults, but one of my faults is that I am a little bit of a, I'll think of something and get excited about it and then sort of let it go. Did I mention that I was interested in starting an Oyster podcast?
Coming soon, yeah, 2025. You know,
I mean, I had the idea like 3 years ago, and still an episode is yet to exist. So, you know, and I remember, like, you know, I've told the story a few times, I think, but like a few months into starting the band, we were practicing a lot. We practiced like two or three times a week religiously. And my family dog got really ill, and I was really upset, and she was going to have to be put down. And then I was like, you know, saying to Joe, I think I just don't really feel like doing band practice tonight. And Joe was like, rang me and was like, you're coming to band practice. I'm sorry about your dog, but band practice is more important.
Oh yeah, he's got that
dog.
He's got that military style.
Yeah, and it's funny, and I should say, the dog miraculously recovered and lived for many more years. So that's a nice ending.
I mean, that's kind of egg on your face. Could you imagine you didn't turn up and they see you walking the dog out the next day?
Terrible.
But what is it they shout? What is it they shout to teams that are failing on the terrace? It's sacked in the morning.
Yeah, exactly. Sacked in the morning. Exactly. So you know, and Joe, I think by his own admission is, you know, he's quite a relaxed, laid back guy. You know, Joe is somebody who you can spend an incredibly enjoyable afternoon with, just sitting around watching TV, talking rubbish and eating crisps, you know. But when it comes to music, he's incredibly disciplined and incredibly focused. And so, you know, he really took the band super seriously and really pushed all of us to do so as well. And
you
that was
need
great.
That though.
Yeah, definitely.
You need somebody who's going to put on the military boots and go for a march. Like
100%.
You mentioned the name, and I hate saying things that I know for a fact I can't pronounce.
Daljit Dhaliwal.
Yeah. And then films.
And then films, yeah.
Which is a great word to say in my accent. Films.
Films, yeah, there you go.
say it again. And then obviously Alt-J. One of the things in just music journalism in general, I think one of the worst questions, the most boring and listless things you can ask somebody is about a name. Mm. And I'm not going to ask you about the name, but I'm going to ask you about, was there others in the pool that you didn't go for?
So I think initially the band, Joe and Gwil, who left after the first album, had done a couple of demos together, and they were calling themselves Anzara, which is Joe's mum's name. So that was the very, very, very first band name, if you want to get really technical.
Some Alt-J fans are going to be writing that down.
Yeah.
Did you know?
And then I think when we were like, I mean, we basically had to change our name from Films because it just became, we were clashing with another band called The Films, and we'd played at this thing called Live at Leeds, you know, Live at Leeds?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
And they'd printed like a picture of, they'd printed our name, but a picture of The Films and a biog of The Films or something. And it was sort of like this, like sort of, where they were from like South Carolina and just sounded a bit dire.
Yeah, and it's not very searchable as well, is it? Like if somebody tries to like go, oh, I love that band, I'm going to search them out, and they go to IMDb.
Yeah, exactly, you know? Exactly. So we sort of got told to change your name. By this point, we had a manager and a lawyer and stuff. So we were kicking loads of ideas around. I mean, Very Heavy was a band name that I think we all quite liked. It's quite a good band name, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not bad.
But I can't remember too many more other than that. But Alt-J really just seemed to work. It was definitely not taken, and it seemed suitably art school to us at the time, so we went for it. Yeah,
like did you go to art school with the idea that you should start a band? I mean, the old adage is that you know, bands like Blur, I think maybe
the Beatles,
Beatles,
and loads, like, yeah,
a lot of famous bands started in art school. Like, was that in the back of your head?
It was for Joe. I mean, I didn't study art, so we were at Leeds University. Joe, Gwil, and Tom were all studying fine art. I was doing English, but yeah, Joe, that was definitely what he wanted. Really, I think, you know, Joe, by the time he was 18 and stuff, was really getting into playing guitar, really getting into writing songs, and wanted to go to university. Yes, to study art, but also to start a band and meet like-minded musicians. And I think he thought art school was the place to do that.
What sort of university students were you? Were you the sort of ones to go out and wear novelty t-shirts and drink six shots for £6? Or were you the sort of more like hipster, sit in, watch like ironic DVDs?
Yeah, I suppose we were probably more the second kind of, and we were not unafraid. We were not afraid of a night out, you know, and we definitely did a bit of that six shots for £6 stuff as well. But I think everybody was doing that at Leeds in 2008. You know, it just was like, it wasn't just sort of like the lads with a capital L who were into that kind of thing. but we were, you know, for sure more into like sitting around and, you know, really playing music and, yeah, talk and watching comedy, watching weird films. And yeah, like you said.
What sort of comedy were you watching? Because I think we were probably at university at the same time. And all my friends were into Family Guy and things like that, and I really didn't like it. So I bought Blue Jam, the Chris Morris comedy.
Yeah, Chris Morris, definitely. Like Dark Place, we all really liked, and that kind of thing. Snuffbox and stuff.
I think the Mighty Boosh was in its peak.
Yeah, right, the Mighty Boosh, exactly. I think it was like, the Mighty Boosh was in a funny place at the time. It had become that, it was that thing where sort of like indie people were sort of starting to hate on it a little bit, you know, because it was too popular. And to be fair, it did go quite savagely downhill in its third series. Sorry.
It's all right. They're coming back now in 2019.
Are they?
I think so. Oh, no, 2020. 2020. Oh, what year are we on? Who Who's the president?
I saw Rich Fulcher, who plays Bob Fossil in what was I watching a couple of nights ago? Marriage Story, the new Noah Baumbach film.
Really?
He plays the judge in the divorce court, I'm pretty sure. Have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
Oh, it's worth a watch. It's pretty depressing. If you're married, I'd say maybe watch it.
Oh, do you know what? I think that's the one that my is it on Netflix?
Yeah.
Yeah, my wife's watched it.
With Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson.
I refuse to watch it.
It's good. It's really good, but it's like, you know, I got married about 9 months ago, and it's like, you sort of watch it, and you're like, shall we just split up now?
Yeah.
Why wait? You know, it's going to happen.
It's the 7th of January.
Yeah.
It's just like, completely tear our lives apart even more than exactly. it'll really need
to. But a little cameo, well, not cameo, it's just a little bit of Bob Fossil is quite funny spot in the divorce court scene. What was I saying? Yeah, so we were really into comedy and really into like odd stuff like that. I mean, I remember Joe had these business cards made in second year for himself as an artist that just had a quote from Garth Marenghi's Dark Place on them, and it just said his name, Jerome Newman, and then said, I had a cat once, I dropped a sofa on it, it was a write-off, so I stood on its head. And that was just all it said on his business cards. So that should tell you what kind of students we were, making weird little references.
Yeah, I can feel that. Like, what does a fine arts student need with a card? As in, like, what was he flogging?
I think it was a bit of a thing. I think it was a bit of a thing at the time to sort of like, you know, I guess it was sort of like felt like a step towards seriousness or something. Mm. I don't know. I think it was also quite a good offer he found, sort of like 100 business cards for a tenner or something like that.
Up next, our website.
Yeah, it was, and I don't know, I think, I don't know, I'm not sure, but he had these cards anyway. I remember him giving them out, and I might still have one, probably worth about £10.
I was in the band at the exact same time, and we only had £200 left of the band account, and the guitarist in the band, after I had a go at him for not doing enough of the admin and industry side of things, spent the last £200 on business cards.
Wow, that's a lot of business cards.
Yeah, who the fuck are we going to give it to? We're in Belfast. You know everybody anyway.
I'm also quite envious that you had £200 in your band account. I don't think that we had that much money in our account until we got signed.
Yeah, well, we were racketeering cigarettes across the border.
Of course.
What were those like early recording sessions like with you guys? Like I saw somewhere that, you know, bass and drums just weren't a thing.
We had some friends who were studying music tech at Leeds Met, and so we went up to their studios for a day to do some recording, and I just had never had that much fun in my life. It was like just sort of messing about. Can I say pissing about? Pissing about with your friends, but also seeing something actually taking shape that really felt proper and real, and seeing the big mixing desk, hearing yourselves played on big studio monitors was just beyond exciting. And somehow that just the giddiness of doing that just made those recording days incredibly fun. That demo we heard earlier, Leon, was as I said, a bedroom recording, and that was just exciting as well. I mean, Gwil had a bit of skill with GarageBand. He was the only one of us who had like a fancy laptop.
Somebody told me this once that one of Mumford and Sons' parents is richer than the Queen.
So we none. I mean,
so where are you in the Premier League table?
Oh God! Like, I mean, we are
middle class bands. We're,
I mean, you know, maybe in terms of accents, some of us might sound a bit posh. I mean, but you know, two out of four of us went to comps. We're not Mumford and Sons.
Okay, right, fair enough.
And
I had some like jodhpurs I was going to give to you. There now,
thank you.
I'll keep them.
Mine are at the dry cleaners. And even just that demo we heard, you know, it goes out of time a little bit and stuff, but actually, we re-recorded that demo in London a few years later and didn't like it as much, even though it was technically more polished. We just kind of found it. We found that Leeds demo had more spirit and more sort of soul.
There's no better feeling than hearing your songs recorded back for the first time properly.
Yeah, exactly.
And like that elation that you get is probably the biggest moment you'll have with that song in your whole life.
It's
really
true, yeah.
Even playing it on stage, but the first time you hear it back from a studio, you're like, this is how it's meant to sound.
It's amazing. It's amazing. It really is, isn't it? And you just, you know, you really are, you know, I think that every musician feels that, even probably Bruce Springsteen making his, you know, 50,000th album, probably, you know, goes back into the control room to hear something back and, you know, he goes, wow, there it is, you know.
Ties a bandana behind his, like over his head and just like nods and goes, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Flicks a Marlboro out of the pack that he keeps in his tucked in his t-shirt.
But like the recordings of those songs they didn't move to the forward that much to the album. Like, you knew what you were doing from the get-go, or did you know what you were doing?
I think we were moving very fast at that time, and we were writing lots of songs and getting very excited about the next one and the next one, you know. Probably, as I said, that probably, you know, explains why Leon never ended up on an album. You know, I couldn't have imagined us writing a better song than that at the time when we did that. But then in the end, it was not really considered for album one because we sort of had, you know, whatever, 10 and 12 other songs that we thought were better and probably were better. Yeah, it was... I think we never had any doubt in ourselves. That was a really, you know, amazing thing. We never really stopped to go, are we doing the right thing? Are we on the right track? You know, we loved the music we were making. I mean, I really think that we were ourselves' favourite bands. You know what I mean? Favourite band. You know, I remember I used to walk around campus with my, listening to those demos we were doing on my iPod all the time, and just like almost couldn't believe that I was listening to my own band. I liked it so much. And that might sound sort of big-headed and weird, but...
No, I get that.
I think it was just, you know, that's sort of the ideal, isn't it? You, when you're making, if you're cooking, you want to make food that tastes delicious to you. And if you're making music, I think you want to make music that you really, really want to listen to. And that was the only real parameter we had as a band, was like, let's make music that we think is great. And we were doing that. And that was amazing.
The difficulty that most bands have is like after they put together a couple of songs and they're really, really happy with it, it's trying to figure out how to get that into the shops, like in probably 2007, how to get that online, and how to navigate that industry side of things, like how to get it out of the Leeds University campus and into the world. Did you have difficulties with that, or did you have people that helped you out along the way? Like, did you go searching for managers? Did you post things off to record labels?
Yeah, we did some unbelievably amateurish stuff. I mean, like, we
go on, hit me with it. I love like hearing.
I remember looking up addresses of labels that we liked and physically posting them CD demos. We never got any responses to those. Like, I think we must have sent some to like XL, or a label called Brill. I don't know if they're still around. Who like Good Shoes were signed to?
Oh yeah, they were great.
I loved Good Shoes. Yeah. And then we also wrote emails. This is really embarrassing. We wrote emails to like management companies of artists that we liked, asking if we could support them. And we sort of wrote this like boilerplate template email, being like, we are huge fans of X and would love to support them. And obviously accidentally sent this email just saying X to some people, to some managers. So embarrassing.
I've had those sent to me. Yeah. And if I'm being honest, I've done the same thing.
Yeah, I mean,
you know. Yeah, of course, you've got to hustle.
Yeah, you've got to hustle. We definitely hustled. And we were really lucky in that we had this, I had this friend from sixth form, Nick, who was working as a scout for a label called Hideout, and he just helped us out absolutely loads with just like, he really liked our music and helped us, he basically just rang me up and one day and was like, oh, my friend Joe is a lawyer. He wants to be your lawyer. And I remember I was just on campus.
What have I done? Have I killed somebody?
Yeah, well, exactly. I was like, what? Why would I need a lawyer? You know, yeah. And he was like, no, you'll need a lawyer. It's good to have a lawyer. So come meet Joe next time you're in London. And so we got this lawyer. And then it just kind of all went from there. They started looking for a manager for us and helping us. We then got a radio plugger who we're still with. Still with a lawyer, still with the radio plugger. And then third, we got a manager who we're still with, you know.
You're a very loyal band. It's very, very, very rare a band that has been going for as long as you have to stay with the whole team. People who don't know about the music industry might be like going, oh, that sounds normal, but it's really not.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the only person we've ever sacked was a publicist, and that wasn't even really our decision. It was the label, really. I mean, yeah, we do pride ourselves on that, you know, and with our crew as well on tour. I mean, I've heard a lot of crew say that like our tour is the favorite tour they've been on, that no other tour is like it, because we really are like a family. And again, I don't want to sound braggy saying that, but we take so much pride in that. It makes me so happy to hear that, because we have a lot of fun on tour. We hang out with our crew all the time and go on days out and eat together, mess about together, you know, drink together after the gig. And there's no separation really, or as little as we try to keep the separation as minimal as we can. Obviously, sometimes we have to travel separately for reasons of load-ins and stuff. But, you know, so, yeah, and a lot of our crew have been with us since, you know, 2012 as well. So, yeah.
How do you treat your tour support bands? I feel like you can tell a lot about a person and, like, in a company, right? how they treat the person who's just starting out. Like they like the how the boss treats the intern is how the boss is. Like I've always thought, right? Yeah. How the band is with the tour support is always like do you sort of like look after them or do you let them sort of batter on?
I mean, we've had some amazingly fun times with our tour, with our supports on tour. I mean, the problem is obviously sometimes you might have a band just for one gig and it can be hard to
Hard to bond over that.
Yeah, it's hard to bond. But I mean, we try to watch them as much as possible. I mean, like Marika Hackman, who supported us a lot on our last album campaign. She lives around the corner, actually. We hung out with her and her band all the time.
Have you ever had a support band that's come on and you thought they're a bit too good? And you're like going, oh shit, we have to go on after them now.
Gosh, that's a good question. I mean, I remember when Clean Bandit were supporting us at Shepherd's Bush, and they were just, not just starting out by any means, but just starting to get big, I guess. And it was like, crikey, you know, these guys are very different to us, but, you know, very, very good. And it wasn't that I was like, wasn't that we were scared to go on afterwards, but I remember being like, wow, this is probably going to be massive. And then it went on to be
the most
streamed song of all time or something.
Yeah, they had that song, Rather Be.
Yeah, yeah, it was just before that came out, I think.
And I think, like, yeah, it was pretty much synced to everything from like a, like from a toilet unclocking ad to like really wants exactly. big weekend. You know
exactly, exactly.
It was everywhere.
It's still a great song. I mean, we did have.
I find it very odd to think of them supporting you.
Yeah.
No.
You've gone different ways a little bit.
You've gone different ways there's a fork in the road and you've gone left and they've gone right.
It's true. I mean, we've definitely not gone down the road of like doing songs with Calvin Harris or getting features from Craig David or whoever.
Or the Cortana ad.
Yeah, Cortana ad. God, it's funny because I sort of know Neil, who used to be in the band, quite well. He's my sort of best friend from school's best friend from uni.
Sure.
And the Cortana ad, I don't think ranks in his proudest moments of all time.
It's all right.
He now works for the Institute for Fiscal Studies, I think, or the Foreign Office. He's very brainy.
Well, I think that's like the natural progression to go from pop music to the Foreign Office, right?
Yeah, yeah. And that's what I hope to do. we did have one support on our last American tour. I'm not going to name names, but it wouldn't be too hard to figure out who it was, who didn't treat us very well.
Really? You don't hear that too often where the tour support is like...
Yeah, and we felt a bit like we were sort of rattling the support and sort of trying to get them to sort of come. We sort of asked them to come for a drink after the show and they had to ask through their tour manager, and tour manager said they would try and make an appearance.
Taken you on a tour.
It was very funny.
Are you kidding me?
I feel a bit bad even not naming names. It's sorry, right, but I mean, it was just like
seriously
so
straight on song kick.
That was quite a long
to find out who that was.
Actually, the band were great, and I'm still friends with some of the band.
Yeah.
So it was just the artist was a bit having a tough time.
Oh well, I mean, touring's very difficult. Like, do you enjoy like touring? Are you one of those bands that live to go on the road, or is it something that's a necessary evil?
We have a great time touring. I mean, obviously it's hard. I mean, that's funny, like I often make a joke about this, like when you're talking to somebody after a gig, like someone's say a family friend comes just to watch you somewhere and they're like, oh, what's it like being on tour? And you get into this loop of going, yeah, it's great fun, but you know it's hard. But of course it's great fun, but you know it's hard. Yeah, but it's fun. And it's true, it's a combination of the two. I mean, you can have we have amazing times. We really enjoy our days off. You get to travel the world, but also there is a hell of a lot of downtime where you're just, sat in a dressing room and you're playing in a venue that's not even in town. So you can't go for a walk and get a coffee and, send a postcard. You're just sort of stuck there and you're bored to tears and quite depressed. Sometimes there's that gap between sound check after lunch and, the gig is like 6 hours long, and
well, that's why people start drinking, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
Because you just drink in to fill the time, really.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and we've luckily not done that, not gone down that road. Save it for after the gig kind of thing. But it's certainly,
especially your gig, like the way you guys play and the dexterity you need to play 90 minutes of your music. It's not exactly like thrash punk where you're just it's three chords.
No, Joe and I have each been drunk on stage once, and each really regretted it and really learnt a lesson. Like mine was at a festival in Germany, and it was raining, and it was one of those gigs where it was raining onto the stage and I was getting really wet and I was really pissed off, didn't want to be there. So I did about four shots and had like four beers, and they were quite strong beers. And I was just hammered by then. I didn't mean to get hammered, but yeah. I think Tom said into his talk back mic to the crew, where he'd say, "Oh, I need a new stick." He was like, "I think Gus is slurring his words." I think I was, when I was talking to the crowd, I was fucking hammered.
Hello, Hamburg.
Yeah, and I came on stage and I was like, I'm never doing that again. It was a horrible feeling. So yeah.
Great to be here, Bremen. You're a wonderful audience.
Yeah, it was not cool.
No, I know. So like the debut album, like, was obviously it took off and did, like, surely you couldn't have even really bartered for what was to happen with that, really?
No, absolutely not. I mean, you know, we were really buzzed to be getting, you know, played by Hugh Stevens on Radio One, and getting, you know, played a bit on Six Music and stuff. And, you know, that was really, I think, what we were pegged for, was indie success, you know, and
Kings of the Underground.
Yeah, and it just massively went way beyond that, to be honest, their first album, and it was crazy. You know, and it was a lot of fun. And I think at the time we took it all on our stride in quite a big way. I think we were touring so much. You know, we toured that first album for about 2 years. And you know, we were just leveling up constantly, like just every next, like in a computer game, every kind of rising cloud, we just managed to jump onto it and got lifted up to the next one. It was like, you know, we played the Borderline, and we played, you know, sort of like Shepherd's Bush, and then it was like, oh, did two Shepherd's Bushes, okay, Brixton, that sold out, two Brixtons, and then it was suddenly Ali Pali, and then the O2, you know, it was just like...
That's crazy, because like, if you don't know, the O2's 20,000 people.
Yeah, I mean, it was bonkers, and then the same in America as well. I mean, like in New York, you know, going all the way from 200 cap venue to selling out Madison Square Garden. I mean, I... Just saying that to you right now, I kind of can't believe we actually did that.
I've been to Madison Square Garden, and it is massive. Like, LCD Sound System had to pretend they were retiring just so they could sell it out.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's just ridiculous. And for us, you know, for a band from Leeds who writing songs about books and stuff, I mean, not to sound falsely modest, but it really is crazy. It was a mad few years for sure.
Has anybody ever worked out the formula to why it was so successful? Is it one of those things that you just don't question and you're like, right, do you know what, let's not figure it out? Like,
I don't know. I mean, I suppose, no, I'm not sure at all. I mean, can you say that about any artist? I'm not sure. I mean, maybe Stormzy represents something about, you know, sort of Britain, 21st century Britain, in a way that really speaks to people. Or maybe he's just an amazing musician who's just really successful because he's really great. I don't know. You could argue it both ways, to be honest. As regards us, I don't know at all. I mean, I suppose in America, maybe we just... I think in America, sort of a couple of British acts every year kind of break, and we just happen to be one of them. I think part of it is that we appeal to a lot of different people, and therefore a lot of different... what you'd have to call markets.
That was a question I was going to ask. I was like, who is a typical Alt-J fan, and is there one?
It's hard to say, really. I mean, probably, like, you know, people who... I don't know. I mean, I think just the fact that, you know, certainly for the first two albums, we were being played on Radio 1, Radio 2, and Six Music, sort of equally. That's kind of crazy, isn't it? Usually you might get two out of three. Mm. It's pretty rare to get three out of three, I think.
If you get across all three... you're generally going to be very successful.
Yeah. And I think it just shows that we were as popular with 16-year-olds as we were with sort of, you know, 50-year-olds.
But isn't that mad to think, like, normally the kid who's sitting in a room, like, digesting and really, like, taking in, like a sponge, yeah, like, your music and thinking, like, this is great, this is very alternative, this is a bit of me. But also... somebody's bought it in Tesco and you have it in the glove compartment.
Yeah,
I think
exactly.
that's the kind of, if you can manage to do that, you're going to be a very, like, well off person. Like,
yeah. We do see when we meet fans, it's often meeting people with their parents, and they're both fans. You know, it's like, oh, my daughter was playing it and now I love it. Or it's like, oh, my mum got me into you, and, you know, or my dad, parents and children sharing the music together, which is really lovely, you know, listening to it in the car together and bringing, I almost said bringing families together.
Bringing families now, together.
Now, okay. I don't mean that, but I mean, you know.
Please call your next album Bringing Families Together.
I think there is something, you know, just like, it's rare as a teenager, I think, to find things that you and your parents have in common. I think everybody could say that. And so I think for a certain generation of people, our music was that.
Two of the big moments I remember from around that time, because I was just about starting radio and I didn't have my own show at that time, but I was covering everybody, was the Mercury Music Prize. And that was at the tail end of 2012. And then the Brit Awards at February 2013.
Yeah.
Both big moments for the band.
Yeah.
What can you remember from that Mercury Music Prize night?
It was great. I mean, bloody hell. You know, again, it was almost like, I think it was this slight sense that everything was preordained in some way, and that of course we won. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was like, how could we not have won? I don't know. I think a lot of people actually, there was almost quite a big backlash in that way, because we were the favourites even before the shortlist was announced. We were favourites to win. And we always really annoyed us at the time, because it was like, I think everybody was saying, oh, of course all J are favourites. And then when we won, everybody, you know, it was quite a lot of, well, of course they won.
Of course it's the best album of the year.
It's like, so we just made an album, you know, it wasn't our decision to be favourites, whatever that even means.
Uh-huh.
But it was certainly absolutely incredible. I mean, hearing our name being read out by Lauren Laverne was just the best thing that had ever happened to us. I can definitely say that, you know. And we had a wicked night, and it just was awesome. And then we went straight back on Luna. We had a gig in Oxford the next day, and it was back to work, but
I bet you didn't sleep.
No, I don't think a lot of sleep was had.
I don't
that
think
night.
So.
No,
I
no.
Don't think so.
I ended up in Dalston. I'd never been to Dalston before. Now I live here. That's where we are right now. Yeah, I remember. But it was great. It was really great.
I remember hearing a rumor like the next day. You know, the way people love like to say it, like, rumors and innuendos and all the rest of it. And somebody told me that you like, thinking back on it now is like, this is such bullshit. Somebody had told me, like, maybe the next day or the day after, that you got the money for it and gone and spent it on a restaurant. Did you hear that rumor?
No, I never heard that. Well, I can tell you where that rumor came from. We sort of said, when people were asking what we did with them, what we were gonna do with the money, we had this plan to take all of our parents out for a big meal.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple of years later, I did invest in a restaurant myself. So maybe the two things have got slightly confused.
Maybe they were combined on that. I was like, well, it must be a pretty expensive restaurant, because like, I think what was the price of that today?
20
like
grand.
20
yeah,
grand.
Yeah.
You're like,
no, and the
actual, I don't think I'll just buy the place.
The sad story. Yeah. It would be a pretty cheap restaurant to buy, or a pretty expensive meal. It was, the sad thing is that we never did that. And we just never, the money just got put in the bank, I guess, and just spent on touring and stuff. I wish that we had done something big with it. Mm-hmm. I wish now that we'd actually given it away, because, you know, we could have done that, and that would have been really awesome.
You didn't know that at that time, though.
No, at the time, you know, and I just think, I sort of, like, I know John Berger, when he won the Booker Prize, I think gave the prize money to the Black Panthers. Like, doing something like that would have been pretty cool.
Yeah, but it's very difficult, like for a band at the start, even with success, because like, you're still skint.
Yeah, well, exactly. We were still. I mean, when we won the Mercury Prize, I was technically homeless. I mean, I didn't have anywhere to live in London. I was staying on friends' sofas and stuff. So it was, you know, exactly, the thought of giving away that money would have been unthinkable. You know.
You kind of bucked the trend with the whole idea of a difficult second album. The second album came out and it was incredible, and like it came out very soon as well. Didn't feel like it was labored over.
That's nice. Yeah, I mean, certainly it couldn't come out soon enough for a lot of our fans, and I think almost we were having to, you know, felt like we were dealing with people being like, "Where's the second album?" We were like, in your city like 3 months ago, you know, we need time to write it. So we finished touring in the Christmas 2013, and then had Christmas off, and then went back in the studio in January, which was also when Gwil left the band. So we were supposed to start in the studio writing on the Monday, and Gwil sort of left on the Thursday before or something. And you know, it'd been brewing with him for a while, and fair play to him, you know, he left it. He had to tell us at some point he was going to leave.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, it wouldn't have been good for him mentally, or you guys either, if it had just dragged out.
No, exactly. And if he'd left on tour, it would have been weird and stuff. And I think if any, you know, it was sad when he left for sure, but I think if anything, it kind of galvanized the three of us who remained, almost like by him leaving and us staying, was almost like we'd rejoined the band. And we were like, no, yeah, we're staying and we're going to carry this on. And so we did. And luckily, writing that second album was a really immensely enjoyable process. We had a writing studio in an old warehouse on some road just by the Hackney Picture House, just off Mare Street in East London, and had some really great parties there. And just were like, really just, it was almost like the first time we were back at, I had a place in London by this point, and we, you know, renting a place, and we were just all like having a lot of fun for sure. You know, like we had a few quid in our pockets, and we were just like,
good album,
a big band. We'd won the Mercury. Yeah, we were fucking early 20s, mid 20s, and you know, it was awesome. It was really fun.
You can deal with the hangovers and still go to work at that age.
Yeah, exactly. Which, trust me, you can't now. No. Anybody young listening, it really, everything you've heard about turning 30 is true. So yeah, it was, that was really fun, and we really enjoyed making that album, and then recorded it, and it went to number one, and it sort of carried on the trajectory of awesomeness, really. I mean,
you've not had a dip, like, at all.
Well, that's nice.
I don't think
you'd say
like,
so.
Like, from a sort of critical standpoint, don't you worry. I'd be the first to stand your neck if you did. Like, I'd be like, they're having a dip. Quick, get the knives out, boys.
I think the third album, you know, didn't sell as many as the first two albums. But I mean,
well, I think that's more symptomatic of album selling less in general.
It's like, partly like, that. It's partly just like a, you know, it's very hard. You know, we were undeniably the new. By that point, we were not the flavor of the month or whatever. We were not a new, young, exciting band. We were a band on our third album, and that's always a funny place to be. And, you know, as we now are about to start making our fourth album, again, it's an interesting place to be. But, you know, you have bands like The Wombats, who, you know, sort of, I'm very good friends with Murph, you know, but I think nobody would have had money on them being as big as they are now. You know, they've kind of come back in an insane way. I went to their Ali Pali gig last year or whenever it was, and most of the crowd were like 16.
They find a new audience. It's almost like a similar story to Liam Gallagher.
Yeah.
If you go to a Liam Gallagher concert now, like, it's kids that are going to his shows.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like the Wombats definitely did have like a dip, like mid career, managed to completely pull it back.
It's absolutely amazing.
It is.
Like, I'm really happy for them. It's really.
It's
great.
Not exactly Phoenix from the Flames. They were never that far.
No,
dipping. Like, but,
no,
but it's incredible to see. And a lot of bands like that you think that you haven't heard of here for quite a while, you go to Germany or Japan or like anywhere around the world. Like a band like the Kooks, say.
Oh, mate, the Kooks in Germany. Yeah.
Huge.
Unreal. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like arenas.
Yeah, yeah, it's incredible. Yeah. So that's, you know, that's always nice to know for us, you know.
What country would be your like second? Like, would the UK be your biggest or would America be your biggest?
I think probably America's bigger than the UK. Bigger. Yeah, because we're bigger. We actually, in the UK, we're quite a London thing.
Yeah.
We don't do that well in like Scotland or like, you know, I mean, we haven't played Northern Ireland actually since our first album, which is, I don't know why that is really, but
Northern Ireland, the only things that sell ticket-wise in Northern Ireland is like really hard dance music, country music, and heritage stuff.
But yeah, I don't know. I mean, yeah, we're certainly like in Europe, you know, we do really well in, you know, Belgium and France and Germany and the Netherlands and stuff. And then, you know, Australia's always been a real home from home for us. You know, have really welcomed us, really embraced us as a country, and we're insanely grateful for that, because you know, you can't get further away from home than Australia. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, we love going there and that sort of thing.
I want to hear about one thing that my fans never hear about, and people like me, like broadcasters, never really hear about, is the corporate gigs that happen, right? And there's one in particular I read you talking about maybe about 6 or 7 years ago. A corporate gig that you did for a Russian telecom company, which was in Iceland.
Yes, probably one of only, I think, two corporate gigs we've ever done, two or three. We've actually always been quite open to the idea of corporate gigs as like a nice payday that, you know, the fans don't even have to know about. So sort of in a way it's win-win, but we don't seem to really get off with them. So yeah, this Iceland one was amazing because we were quite, you know, this was like Yeah, so it was first album, and we were still sort of took ourselves quite seriously, quite arty, and it was in like a sort of reproduction of a Viking feasting hall, and
it's like the Game of Thrones kind of vibes.
Very Game of Thrones, exactly. Yeah. They were, I think they asked us if we would, but they were like, "Oh, will you play Happy Birthday to our CEO?" And we were like, "No."
What does Happy Birthday sound like in a, as an alt J song?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm sure that somebody on SoundCloud could have a go at that. Happy Birthday, 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 Birthday. So we were like, no, we're actually quite a serious band. Also, we're actually terrible pickup musicians. I mean, we probably couldn't play Happy Birthday. Like, I don't think we really know how. I mean, we could sing it, but what the hell are the chords? I don't know. Yeah. And then they were like, oh, also another thing, we're all going to be dressed as Vikings. Would you guys mind dressing as Vikings as well? We were like, no, flicking our fringes. And then actually then our tour manager, Sarah, who sadly has now left the industry, sadly for the industry, I mean, she was quite a sort of no-nonsense.
She's no full-time Viking, no, yeah.
She's a Viking lawyer. She's a no-nonsense lawyer. But I remember her sort of being saying to us, like, guys, come on, you know, it's a bit of a laugh. They are paying you quite good money. Why don't you just do it? Like, what? Stop taking yourself so seriously. Stop. Take their fucking sticks out of your asses. Yeah. Put on the Viking costumes. We were like, all right. So we did, and it was hilarious.
This is so Spinal Tap.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you could do a whole, you know, we could write a PhD on how much being in a band is exactly like Spinal Tap. Yeah, because it really is. But so we ended up putting on all these furs and sort of leather belts and helmets and things and playing the gig dressed as Vikings. And we had an incredibly good laugh doing it.
Is there any sort of other Spinal Tap sort of war stories that come to mind when you think back on?
Crikey.
What was that all about?
I mean,
why do we do that?
It's amazing how often you do get lost between the dressing room and the stage. Stages can be very hard to find.
Let's go, Alt J!
Yeah, like, exactly.
10 minutes later.
Yeah.
Where are we?
I mean, I don't know. Nothing springs to mind immediately, but yeah, it is very, very like that, you know. That corporate gig was very funny.
So I've only got a couple of questions left before we wrap up the podcast. I want to know what it was like to be on University Challenge.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't see that episode. So was it just you that went on, or was it the whole band?
Just me, yeah. It was funny, actually, because they offered it to Joe, being the lead singer. And Joe, I think, would be the first to admit that, like, quizzes and stuff are not really his thing.
Yeah.
And I was sort of like, please, can I do this? And I sort of emailed back and said, would they have me? You know, like, I would just be, because I grew up watching it with my dad. I mean, it's just like a huge part of my childhood and adolescence watching University Challenge.
See, here's the question. How many did you get right? I would watch it with my mom, and whoever got the least amount of questions right had to make the cup of tea.
Okay. Well, watching it with my dad was a nightmare, because my dad is just like insanely intelligent, but also just knows a lot of stuff, facts and stuff. But I mean, I was quite good. And so the reason I put my hand up for it was because I actually thought, it wasn't that I wanted to be on TV. It was that I thought I'd actually do quite well. And we did. So our team got to the final. I did in the first round match and the semi-final, I did really well, got loads right. And then in the final, I didn't get a single one right. And we just got absolutely bollocked by a female college from Oxford. I can't remember what college it was. St. Margaret's or something.
Is there a question that you can remember from it that haunts you?
Yes, there
go,
is.
Go on, ask me, because I definitely
so it was. It was basically I can't remember exactly how the question was phrased, but it was like, "What? Whose Saint's Day is the 6th of December?" Bear in mind, it's a Christmas one.
Oh God. Who's a Christmas saint apart from Jesus? Like
St. Nicholas. St. Nicholas. Santa Claus.
Oh, yeah. Okay, right. That makes so a lot of sense.
I buzzed in and said St. Stephen, and I know that St. Stephen's Day is Boxing Day, because that's what you call it in Ireland.
Yeah, that's what we call it in Ireland.
Oh, and God, I buzzed in, and the second I said St. Stephen's Day, I was like, it's not St. Stephen's. I know it's not. And I knew it was fucking St. Nicholas, because I used to have a Dutch girlfriend, and they really, for them, the 6th of December, Sinterklaas is like sort of like their Christmas.
Right, yeah.
They have their stockings on the 6th of December in Holland, and celebrate.
Poor old Jesus, like,
I know, right? Jesus doesn't get looking. It's all about St. Nicholas, and he comes to Holland and all this stuff. And I was just really annoyed with myself, because I gave a stupid answer, and that was one of the ones I could have got right if I'd thought about it. But I was so panicked. I was getting so many wrong. It really does haunt me.
It could be worse. Like the week that we record this, a video has gone viral. I think it might have been Mastermind.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a young lady on it, and the question was like, who is the Swedish climate change activist yep. who stood up in front of the UN and talked?
Sure.
And the young girl sat there and she was like, oh, I don't know, Sharon?
Sharon.
And it was obviously Greta Thunberg. Yeah, like,
yeah. Not even offering a surname, just Sharon.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? It could be, it could have been a lot worse.
It didn't end up in, Private Eye has a little thing called Dumb Britain, which is like quiz shows, people giving horrendously bad answers on quiz shows. And, you know, I wouldn't have made it to that, but it does annoy me. but it was amazing to be on there. I mean, you know, getting to go to the studio. I'll show you in a minute. I've got you get to keep your like acetate name label for your light box.
Mm-hmm.
So
oh wow, you get to keep that.
Yeah, so not you don't get the whole light box. It just comes. It's just like a piece of you know the stuff that you put on the projector.
Yeah,
that kind
of
plastic sheeting.
Uh-huh.
You get to keep that with your name on it because obviously they couldn't reuse it because it's been printed with your surname.
Yeah, so of course.
I've got mine, and my friend made it into a light box for me, which I have above the door there, and it's really cool. I think you're gonna like it.
I'm pretty. I'm in on that. Like I wanted a university challenge just because I want that. Like I'll not get anything right.
Yeah,
I'll just
yeah.
And pick my nose and like.
It was cool. It was very cool. It's yeah.
So what is as we record this in January 2020? What is the year hold for Alt-J? What is the year hold for yourself?
So we are gonna be working on a new album this year. I don't know how much I. There isn't a lot to give away, really, other than the fact that we are planning to, very soon get together in a room and write songs. So that's the plan. I don't know how long it's going to take.
Do you write in London? Do you write like in LA? And like, what do you do?
No, I mean, I suppose, you know, Joe being the main songwriter, he writes on his own time and stuff. But there's also things that we sort of jammed on tour that we've got recordings of in sound checks and stuff that we want to work on. And then also there's always, you know, a few spontaneous things that come up when we're just in the room. That's the really exciting bit, I think, is just when the three of us to get together and write. So we've got a little place in around the corner near Kev. No doubt I'll be seeing him even more.
From Two Door Cinema.
I've just given away where he lives. And you're welcome, Kev. And his address is. So that would be, you know, just be really nice just to almost like have office hours. You know, that's usually how we do it. I mean, I'm not saying 9 to 5, it's probably more like 11 till 4 with a pretty long lunch break, but you know, Monday to Friday working on music, and it's great fun. Yeah.
Thank you so much for inviting me into your very, very nice home.
Thank you for coming.
Good luck with the year. I can't wait to hear the fruits of the labors.
Cheers. Thanks a lot, Phil. Thanks for having me.